Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. It is my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Marty Nemco, discussing What's the Big Idea? Marty Nemco is an American career coach, author, columnist, and public radio host specializing in career, workplace issues, and education reform. He has education from the University of California, Berkeley, and Queens College and City University of New York. The San Francisco Bay Guardian named Nemco the Bay Area's best career coach. U.S. News described him as job coach extraordinary. In its Summit on Education, ABC TV called him the Ralph Nader of education. He's a regular contributor to Time.com and PsychologyToday.com. He has written over 3,000 published articles. For example, he wrote the Big Idea feature on WashingtonPost.com and Working It Out column in The Atlantic and Under the Radar column for 6 years in the San Francisco Chronicle. He has authored 8 books, his latest being The Best of Marty Nemco, the best of his 3,000 articles on your career, living and making a difference. His other books include Cool Careers for Dummies, How to Do Life, What They Don't Teach in School, and What's the Big Idea? 39 Disruptive Proposals for a Better Society. Many of you probably know him for his hosting in the program Sunday mornings, Work with Marty Nemco on KALW 91.7. Okay, so without further ado, Marty.
Thank you, Bill. After that, I better not suck. So anyway, really, I'm very happy to have you here. And I will try to keep things stimulating. We come here to the Commonwealth Club for networking. We come here for new ideas. And we brave the wind and the cold and walking 4.5-5 blocks, whatever it is, from BART or driving or whatever. So I have spent my time to prepare carefully for you, and I will try to make it worth your while. I think it's fun in our lives that are kind of drowned down with the boring, ordinary things like, oh, I got to call the Comcast guy, or, oh, my God, I've got to, my cell phone is out, I got to charge it. All of the crap we got, our jobs, our relationships, cleaning up, making dinner, shopping, finding a parking spot, Jake. It's fun to be able to get out of, the fancy word is, quotidian activities, day-to-day activities, to think big. Either just because it's fun to think big, but maybe even it affects who we vote for, what we volunteer for. And so we're going to talk about some of the biggest problems facing society today. And I'm going to pretend I'm the emperor. And I'm going to say, these are the things I would do, hopefully not the same old, but hopefully fresh ideas for addressing these big societal problems. But lest I be academic pie in the sky, I also realize that each and every one of us has issues, day-to-day issues around our career, around our health, around our children's education, whatever. So I will try to offer very practical solutions in addition to the big policy stuff, okay? And I'm going to cover a lot. I'm going to be covering, as you can see in your cheat sheet, I'm going to be covering jobs, the hollowing out of jobs. I'm going to be covering education, America's most overrated product, healthcare. It's scary what's going to be coming about the number of medical errors and the number of additional people who are low pay and high need who are going to be covering. What are we going to do? Then terrorism. We spend all these trillions, but it doesn't seem to be. Terrorism seems to be increasing. Or Israel. I mean, a 3,000-year-old problem doesn't seem to be going away. What are we going to do about the Israel-Palestinian-Arab conflict? And finally, the U.S. debt, federal debt, is $19.44 trillion. Can we really keep going? Well, by the way, $1.25 trillion to China. What are we going to do? So I got my hands full. I'm going to try to cover each of those briefly just to whet our appetites. Then we'll do Q&A. And then everything I'm doing today is going to be custom for you, 100%, except the last story. So after the Q&A, I will tell you a story that has maybe the most important lesson of all. That's my way of making sure you don't leave early. Anyway, so let me begin. Let me start with the jobs thing. I like to start by telling you about the problem, and then we'll go to solutions. The problem. The Social Security Administration just came out with statistics that says, guess what percentage of people in the United States of America earn less than $30,000 a year? Less than $30,000 a year. Anybody want to make a guess? 51%. More than we live in this rarefied Commonwealth Club atmosphere of the intelligentsia. 51% of all human beings living in the United States of America live on less than $30,000 a year. And lest you think that is merely the multigenerational poor, The Atlantic reported a major study that found that, this was 2 years ago, but it hasn't changed a whole lot, I'm guessing, that's just a guess. But as of 2 years ago, guess the percentage of people with college degrees who are either unemployed or doing work they could have gotten out of high school. 53, you can look it up. More than half. All of those young people who, not the ones who went to Stanford and Berkeley, they're employed. But there, for every Stanford and Berkeley, there's 100 San Francisco States and St. Mary's College of California and St. Mary's College of Maryland, St. Mary's College of Texas, and the millions of other 3,000 colleges. And when you cover all of them, we're talking half. Half doing our Uber drivers or the equivalent or unemployed. Big, scary problems. We're going to start with my suggestions for what the, quote, big ideas for what individuals might do to survive in this world. And there's one more thing I want to say prefatory to that, which is we all hear about the gig economy, that ever more employers are taking jobs that in previous generations would have been full-time, permanent, benefited 52 weeks a year, and now they're part-time temp project gigs if they're not offshore or automated, right? Well, it makes sense that they're doing that because on one hand, as a human being, probably all of us feel good about health care for all. It feels like a right, but it's all on the back of the employer. So he or she at the employer has got to pay that. We all say workers' compensation, it's a good right if somebody's hurt on the job. But the fees for that go way up because there's a lot of some malingering, let's just say some, all on the backs of the employer rate. We wrongful termination suits. We all expand the rights for, feel good about the rights for women, minorities, gays, lesbians, transgenders, but all of those rights lead to more lawsuits. All burden cost of the employer. So the employer, and I can go on and on. Social Security limits raised, with half of which goes on the employer. So employers are saying, hey, if I got to pay all of that on top of the salary for full-time benefited employees, and especially here in the Bay Area, we know that our colleges are teaching students to say corporations suck. So we have a lot of workers who really don't like employers. So why would an employer want to hire them when they really don't like them? They cost a fortune. And study after study shows that even college graduates are coming out with very poor literacy skills. So they're taking as many jobs as possible to avoid all of that and hiring on a just-in-time project basis for this week, this month, minimal benefits, etc. Scary stuff for whether you're younger or you're older, for yourself, for your children, for your grandchildren. That's the problem. Solutions. Magic pills ain't going to get here, but my best solutions include the following. Number one, and we're going to start with individuals, so we'll talk about societal solutions in a minute. Individual solutions. First of all, there are going to be, over the next 10, 20, 30 years, there are going to be a number of jobs that will be resistant to the gig economy, that will continue to be full-time benefited. And they have to have the following characteristics. They have to be, again, fancy word, consistent with the zeitgeist of the era, consistent with the spirit of the era. So I'll give you an example. An autism psychologist. There's a good example of something, it's not offshoreable. There's enormous demand. The rates of autism, or at least the diagnosis of autism, are increasing. New laws have made sure that mental health is covered exactly to the same level as physical health. So it's mandated by government, which means those services are going to be provided. And so if you are a psychologist specializing in autism, you're probably not going to have to work 10 part-time project-based. You're going to have a job that's going to pay well, and it's also really high need. Any parent of an autistic kid knows it's a real challenge. You're going to pay whatever, and the insurance companies are going to pay whatever, and single payer will pay whatever, and we are going to move to single payer. So there's an example of the kind of career that will be resistant. Another couple of examples. Physician assistant. Right now, we already, and I'll talk about this more later, our healthcare system is already overwhelmed. There are so many medical errors, depending on which study you believe, between 100 and 400,000 a year of medically caused deaths in hospitals alone. Not counting excess morbidity, which is longer recovery periods, side effects, whatever. The system is already broken. And when Hillary gets elected, and she, you know, every study shows, 538.com, Nate Silver from the formerly New York Times, 85% chance she'll win, and most polls say it's going to be a landslide. So Hillary is going to be the president. And Hillary, she's stated many times, one of her first priority, maybe her first priority, is comprehensive immigration reform. And that's going to mean that there's going to be 11 million more illegal immigrants who will be legal and therefore fully covered by whether it be Obamacare or, I believe, she's also wanted single payer down the road. This is not going to happen tomorrow or next year, but over 10 years, definitely. So that's going to create an enormous need for what are called I'll call them second tier healthcare providers, not doctors, because they take too much time to train, too expensive, etc. Physician assistants and nurse practitioners, not physical therapists, but physical therapy assistants, not anesthesiologists, but nurse anesthetists, or some people, there are people called anesthesiology assistants. Those are not offshoreable. They are under the radar and are rewarding careers that will continue and burgeon, in my judgment. So if you or somebody you care about is contemplating a career, and there's millions of this, forensic accountant, there's program evaluator, ever more money, ever larger part of GDP, gross domestic product, is distributed by a grant process. Right, a nonprofit writes a grant, or a government agency writes a grant. Grant writers, that ain't going, there's a lot of subtlety to that. That's not going to India. Those jobs are going to be here, in demand. On the other end of these programs, when they get funded, every program has to, by law, in most cases, be evaluated. They need program evaluators. Nobody has ever grown up saying, I want to be a program evaluator. But it's a wonderful career. And it ain't getting offshored, and it's going to be a way to resist the gig economy. Why is it a great career? Think about it. 1 month, you're evaluating an AIDS prevention program in the Native American community. Next, you're doing a dropout prevention program. Next, you're doing a reading readiness program. You're getting to see all these wonderful new innovations and help determine, is it good? Is it bad? How could it be improved? You laughed at program evaluator. Great under-the-radar career. Those are the ways you avoid the gig economy. Other ways, of course, government jobs are a way to avoid the gig economy. It is unseemly. It would cost too many votes for the government to convert too many of their jobs into part-time temp jobs, because it's the kind of thing they want to fight. So still, the government is turning some jobs into part-time temp, but they disproportionately are full-time, benefited, 14 holidays, 13 vacation days, pensions, retirement, everything. Not going to be offshored, not going to be less likely to be part-time. Government work, it's old news. Third example, and then I'm going to move off this. Most self-employed people go out of business within a few years, but most of my clients don't. I'm going to tell you why. Because of a core principle I believe is that status is the enemy of contentment. Most people who start businesses, create a startup, they do biotech and high tech and all those cool things. Or they open a fancy restaurant. They're almost certain to fail for a number of reasons. The cost of starting those businesses are so high. You're competing with the most successful people on the planet in the case of biotech and high tech. Very tough to win in those wars. Then you're in fast-moving technology. So that you spend 2 years coming trying to bring to market your cool app. Well, before you've got it done, some big corporate, there's millions of apps, somebody else has developed a better app, and you're dead. So what I have had my clients do instead is to recognize that status is the enemy of the contentment. And as long as you're providing a good product or a good service at a fair price, you will survive as long as your competition isn't great. And I want to give you one, I call them shoestring businesses that are clonable. I'm going to explain what I mean. Many of you, as you walked here, passed a flower stand. Is that correct? And the flower stand is nothing more than some carpenter put together some boards and there's some vases in there, and that's it. The margins on flowers are enormous. They may cost $2 a dozen. They sell them for $20 a dozen. Flowers never go out of style. Yes, you or somebody's got to go there to the flower market 3 in the morning and get them so that they're fresh, get the good ones. Yes. But businesses like that have cost little money. There's no fad risk. No corporation's going to take you over. And the beauty of it is it's clonable, meaning you run the first flower stand. So you learn everything about pricing, customer service, timing, everything, arranging. But once you've got it down, you hire one of your friends to staff that cart so they're not going to steal from you, less likely to steal from you. And then you open another great location near a BART station or whatever. And even if that one flower cart or flower stand made $30,000 a year, you have 10 of them and you're now making a hell of a living. Those businesses, can you see how those have a far greater chances of success than high-tech, biotech, cool restaurant, sports bar, whatever? So that's a third way for the entrepreneurially oriented. And you don't have to be a genius at it. For a reasonably entrepreneurially oriented person, a way to avoid the gig economy is to take control of the situation yourself by being your own boss. But you've got to realize that status is the enemy of contentment. Now, those are individual things you can do, but I also said, this talk's called What's the Big Idea? So now I want to talk about macro things, the big things that we could do to create jobs. And I am in favor of creating something called a jobs army. Just like our regular army has the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, my jobs army is going to have three branches. One is called the service branch. We'll call it the public service branch. Another is the entrepreneurship branch. And the third is called the assistance branch. So we'll call them the service army, the entrepreneurship army, and then the assistance army. Let me flesh those out for you. Public service. Here's where, you know, you're going to hear some of my ideas are very liberal, like I'm like single payer. And I'm, this is a very liberal argument I'm about to make. And some are going to be conservative. Wisdom does not reside left of center. The Bay Area thinks so. Wisdom resides across the spectrum. Depends on the issue. So, the service army. This is really like the Roosevelt administration's WPA, Work Project Administration. We all know, both the right and left agree that the infrastructure needs workers. And yes, this is where the government should create jobs, take some of our seed corn, some of the tax dollars, and use it to create jobs that would have better, yes, roads, not just public transit, because the road, people are sitting in gridlock, it's crazy. But more roads, better bridges and tunnels, more security, whatever is needed for infrastructure, government, good government jobs, for those who are not intellectuals, for people who are more working with their hand types. I really think we need to have government-created jobs. And also beautification. I went to Woodminster Musical Theater recently, built by the Work Project Administration, a gorgeous amphitheater that the private sector could never afford to build. It's gorgeous. It's a great public service activity. So that's one branch of the jobs army, kind of like a new Work Project Administration. Two is the entrepreneurship army. It is absurd that our schools and our colleges, the one course that they teach less that's more important is entrepreneurship. They're busy teaching quadratic equations. They're busy teaching the cause of the Peloponnesian Wars. They're busy teaching how to deconstruct Milton. How elitist is that when you have people who are desperate to have survival skills and, in this case, to learn the one thing that could keep them from being marginalized, entrepreneurship? So the entrepreneurship army would be created through by a government and private sector mandated or not, they don't have to be mandated, a greater effort to do more entrepreneurship education from kindergarten on, from the lemonade stand on. Always with ethics primary, sleazy businesses disgust all of us, but successful, profitable, ethical entrepreneurship should be at the core of our education long before we decide to teach people what the symbolism is in the doppelganger in 18th century German literature. From kindergarten all the way through graduate school, the entrepreneurial angle, whether it be for-profit, you can be an entrepreneur in a nonprofit sector too. The entrepreneurial mindset, it's called intrapreneurial, thinking about money-making ways for a nonprofit to make money is not bad. It is good as long as it's ethical. That's the second army, the entrepreneurship army. The third is the assistance army. The assistance army is this. Most of us, unless we're rich, our mindset doesn't think about hiring somebody to help us with the baby, to help us tutor ourselves in technology, to help our child as a homework helper, to help us, to help our elder parent. We tend to, unless we're upper middle class or richer, we tend to not think about it. But what better use of our discretionary money is that compared to buying another pair of shoes we don't need, or another vacation at another Holiday Inn in wherever we're going, or a fancy jewelry, or a car that's got a fancy nameplate when a plain old Toyota runs better, more reliably, and cheaply? So if we educated the public to reallocate some of their spending from that crapola to hiring assistants. Now, I'm not saying those assistants can get paid a whole lot, but collectively, they could be, those jobs can be at least part of a portfolio career that's, again, completely ethical, helping people enormously, and it would create lots of jobs without spending taxpayer dollars. So that's my macro suggestion for how to create jobs in America. Let's turn now to education, topic number two. Again, we start with the statistics. They're unbelievable. Where would you guess the United States of America ranks in per student spending on education K-12? Number one. We spend more than anybody else. Now, there are different studies. Some say we're number four. Some say we're number two. Some are number one. But I read the CBS.com had this big article about that we spend number one per capita. So it doesn't matter. We're near the very top. Nobody could argue we don't. We're near the top. And where are our, in every time they do the PISA, which is the International Comparison of Student Achievement, where do we fit? Near the very bottom, we're floundering like a catfish at the bottom of the sea with at the bottom of the among developed nations. Money ain't the answer. We're tinkering with the problem. And here I'm going to sound conservative. The unions are destroying us. They're so eager to keep their jobs, no matter how terrible they are. They're so resistant to growing. And in the previous generations, teachers were much better because before the women's movement, the best and brightest women saw teaching as the highest level job they could get. So there were brilliant, amazing women teachers teaching our children. Now, 51% of all law school students are women. 50% of medical students are women. 50% of MBA students are women. 85% of veterinary students are women. So right now, this, the SAT, the average SAT score, which is a proxy of reasoning skills of teachers, is the very bottom. So we have very low-level teachers protected by iron-fisted unions, who are very technology phobic, so they can't individualize using technology. And that is a real source of the problem. Now I'm going to start talking about solutions for you as individuals, for your children, for yourself, for your grandchildren, and then societal solutions. Real growth occurs one-on-one. It does not occur in a class of 50. Even if they lower class size to 15 from 30, that's another union strategy to make it easier for teachers. Think about it logically. If you have 30, if you're getting 1/30th of a teacher's class time, and now you're getting 1/15th of a teacher's class time, is that really going to, you know, make such a big difference? It won't. What matters is one-on-one. Whether it's with a brilliant interactive online lesson with a transformative teacher, or peer instruction, or one-on-one mentoring, anything other than class. So for you as individuals, you need to realize the millions of parents for generations have tried to change the schools. Forget it. They just figure you'll go away. They say nice things. They let you go to meetings. They form task forces in the PTA, and then nothing changes. You need to get one-on-one for your kid, whether it be tutoring, and it could be for bright kids. My grandchild, I swear, she's six. She understood the New York Times. I just got a call. She understood an article in the New York Times. They're making her read little baby stuff and teaching the weaker students to read. She's bored out of her gourd. And no doubt if she were a boy, they'd put her on Ritalin. The schools aren't going to change. Yes, try to get your kid in a school where kids are similar to you in academic functioning, your grandkids or whatever. Yes, try to get teachers who are sensitive to your child's needs. But in the end, it's going to be about one-on-one. Tutor for remediation, tutor for supplementation. Great activities for, you know, great summer camps. Camps do a very good job. Sports camps, computer camps, nature camps, art camps. I see those kids in these small groups really coming alive, wanting to learn. So one-on-one, and that applies to you too. Your age, I don't care if you're 90. We all want to grow until they put us in the box. That's what the Commonwealth Club's about. Not all of you are kids here. You're here because you want to learn. You want to grow. But it occurs not so much from this, but from one-on-ones. Find a mentor. Be a mentor. Find a tutor. Don't be ashamed. If you're 70 years old and you're still using only one-tenth of the features on your smartphone, go hire a kid to help teach you. You'll grow. It's better. Right? One-on-one. But it's not a class. It's about transformation. Transformation occurs one-on-one. Next practical tip. In 1970, only 40% of all students went to college, high school students. Now it's 73%, and here in the Bay Area it's more like 85%. We have the largest percentage of college graduates probably anywhere in the world. I have not documented that statistic, but just frankly it's just an intuition. So a degree from Harvard or Stanford or Berkeley still will open lots of doors. But if your child or your grandchild is saying, well, I think I'm going to go and major in psychology at San Francisco State or art or history or women's studies or gender American studies, all of that, those are, if I'm being really straight with you here, employers yawn at those degrees because they're ubiquitous. They do not testify to great understanding and knowledge. They more often, as I implied earlier or said earlier, they testify to antipathy to business, right? Think about, make believe you're an employer here in the Bay Area and you see somebody graduating from San Francisco State with a degree in gender studies, American studies, whatever, even politics, whatever. Aren't you a little nervous that that person really is metaphorically giving you the finger? So think three times. If your kid is kind of a marginal student, kind of, you know, tremendous grade inflation, amazing how much the grade inflation is in high school and college, enormous. So if your kid is a B student, which is in old days would have been a C student, with moderate motivation, and he or she is going, contemplating, yeah, I think I'll start and I'll go to Cal State East Bay, or St. Mary's, or whatever they'll take me. You know, the cost of a St. Mary's and of most of the private colleges is very close to what an Ivy is. And the true cost of those schools, the true cost when you add everything, is about $300,000 for 4 years. $300,000 for 4 years. And the dirty secret is that most students, especially the weak students I've been describing, they don't graduate in 4 years. If they're lucky, they graduate in 5 or 6 years. Did you know that 40% of all college freshmen do not graduate even if given 6 years? So do not reflexively decide that college is the answer. It may be the answer if the kid likes school, if there's good structure, if the kid is going to get into Berkeley or Stanford or whatever, because that still matters. But there may be other options that you may want to consider. An apprenticeship program, a short career training program at a community college, learning at the elbow of an ethical entrepreneur, something college is not necessary. If in fact, it's not just about career, if college really did create broader thinkers, good writers, effective citizens, not just somebody who holds a placard, but thoughtful citizens, then fine. But there, if you look up a study called Academically Adrift, which is the largest study to date about higher education, 45% of all, it's either 36 or 45%, graduate college essentially having grown not at all in reading, writing, and critical thinking skills. So don't believe the brochure, believe the data. And the cost is just enormous. Okay. Now to the major societal problem, solving the education problem, macro. I think the most important thing we could do, and I briefly alluded to it, but I'm not going to flesh this out. In all of my 66 years on this planet, my single best idea is something called supermodules. Imagine this. Think about Algebra 1. It is considered the gateway course, the critical course. Every activist is saying, this is the course we got to get more kids through. Think back to your Algebra 1 course. Believe me, it's not very different today. Do they not teach you the distributive principle? Do they not teach you quadratic equations, balancing equations, the area of the parabola, geometric theorems, all that? Well, that's in geometry, but am I correct? Is that the material? And there are two, if you're lucky, there are two trains, one left from Cleveland at, you know, to noon, the other one left Pittsburgh at 7. What time did they meet? Who cares? Anyway. Most people go into math as a field because they're not the greatest communicators. They're more math purple people than verbal people. So you have a pool of teachers who, on average, are not that great at communicating, at the same time as you have a very difficult subject to teach, right? But there is the rare anomaly, to use the current term, the unicorn, who is brilliant and transformed. Not brilliant. There are a lot of brilliant teachers. They cover the board with formulas. That doesn't make them a good teacher. But there are a few rare transformative teachers who have the ability to bring the beauty of math to life and get kids to understand it in their fabric so that they think mathematically, which is very important in life. It doesn't matter whether you can solve the quadratic formula. That's garbage. But to think mathematically, probabilistically, think about reason, thinking about balance, thinking about all those things mathematically, that's a useful skill. But only 1 out of 1,000, maybe, if we're lucky, teachers have that. So now imagine that instead of the 46,000 algebra teachers that kids get at random, good, mostly mediocre, some terrible, we found a dream team of the 3 or 4 most transformational math teachers. And we put them in a room with a computer programmer and a gamifier, somebody from Electronic Arts or the world's leading, or Disney Games or whatever. We said, okay, you three brilliant transformative math teachers, divide up the algebra course into the parts of it that you teach best. So now you got the best teachers teaching what they teach, the very stuff they teach very best. Working with the gamifier, the person from the computer gaming company, they create highly immersive, interactive, simulation-oriented lessons, modules, that are 15 minutes long. Today is about internet time. A 50-minute classroom period is an eternity. Kids watch 2-minute YouTube videos, 1-minute YouTube videos. So 15 is about as much as you're going to get. 15-minute modules, most transformative teacher, teaching the most important concepts in algebra, gamified, and then a computer programmer to make it happen. That would enable every kid, rich, poor, urban, rural, black, white, green, in Azerbaijan to Zambia, to have world-class instruction. That is my best idea. Everybody says it's a great idea, and the unions will never allow it. Because they know that much as I can say, oh, the teacher will be there to provide the human touch and to provide individual instruction and classroom management, they don't believe it. They know that that's going to eliminate jobs. And the union has much of government, I'll just say it that way, in its hip pocket. And so this is not cheap. can't be funded. It can't be funded. But that's the most potent way to really change education. Another thing, as I said, one-on-one is very, very important. Mentor match. Everybody, whether you're a child or to your grave, most of us go to our grave, wish we had a mentor. Somebody who took us under wing and said, you know, I think you're special. I think you haven't lived up to your potential, and I'm going to help you do it. We're going to do it together. Most of us have kind of prayed that somebody at college or whatever, at work, was going to say, you're special, and I really like you. Let's do it together. Doesn't happen. Why don't we take a lesson from Match.com? Do you know how many millions of marriages now have gotten together, or eHarmony, or OkCupid, or whatever? Because these detailed profiles match people together. Why do we not take people who want to be a mentor, have them complete a long profile and a short online training program, and match them with people, children, adults, older people who would like to be a protege? Of course, some will fail. Like all relationships, they don't all work. But what a wonderful way to match people. And in an era of Skype and FaceTime, they can be communicating without risk of somebody being a rapist or whatever. You know, it's always the big fear about mentor, you know, with children. There's no perfect solution. But think about if one-on-one is education matters, what better way to do it than to create mentor match? And finally, the colleges have gotten a free pass from the media because the colleges tend to educate in the way that the media likes it to. So they get an enormous free pass. When, as I said, the results in terms of for the enormous amount of money that people spend, and I've been a consultant to 15 college presidents, so I've seen colleges from the inside. They are businesses like any other business, and all they care about is money. They do not care about students. They care about research grants. They care about prestige. They care about their jobs. The amount of education bureaucracy has gone crazy in the last 20 years. The percentage of dollars that have gone into education administration has skyrocketed. So if we and the government, again, in the hip pocket of the damn universities, they did have some kind of a college report card. It doesn't give the good information. It's garbage information. How much financial aid you're going to get, what percentage graduate in 6 years. That's nothing. What's really needed is for every college to have a report card on its homepage, not buried at the Department of Education website. They need a report card at the homepage of the college that says not only what percentage of students graduate, what percentage of students with this major who majored in art are middle class employed within 6 months of graduation. What percent graduated in 4 years? What percent graduated within 6 years? How much debt? And how many of them are middle class employed within 6 months of graduation by major? What percentage of students, what is the distribution of students' growth in reading, writing, critical thinking, and mathematical reasoning? Those are the two things that count, growth and employability. That's a report card. Putting it required to having it, and that's where, again, it's a liberal argument, on the homepage, government mandating it go on the homepage of every college so that everybody choosing a college can see which is adding the most value for their hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, we mandate that every passenger tire has molded into its sidewall its tread life length, its traction rating, and its temperature rating. But we don't require colleges, which cost 100 times as much, profoundly affecting people's lives. We require nothing of the colleges. All we require, what we do is we give them a lot of money. Because all those Pell Grants, and I'm not going to probably have time to talk about it today, but all those Pell Grants or whatever, they want you to think, oh, that enables more kids to go to college. And every politician knows it sells. Doesn't do that at all. Because as an insider, I know, when the colleges know that they raise the Pell Grant amounts, which is the amount of money the students get, that simply enables them to raise their tuition. So the money goes into the coffers of the college. It contributes to the fat administrations. There's very few of any kids end up going to college because Pell Grants get increased, but it gets votes to the politicians. because instead they can either raise tuition or, because when they don't get a Pell Grant, then the college has got to take money out of its own coffers. And, you know, places like Berkeley and UCLA and Stanford and Harvard, they raise hundreds of millions of dollars. They have enormous endowments. You ever go on campus, the fanciest office on campus is going to be the development office. Development is financial, is fundraising. They have the most sophisticated operations in the world. So that's the real answer is a college report card. I'm looking at the time, and I have done a very bad job. I have much to say about healthcare, much to say about terrorism, the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and the national debt. I think what I'm going to do is I'm just going to do healthcare. Let me see what I need to do. Let me do healthcare briefly, and then, because I'm looking, it's almost 6:45 already. Healthcare. Here is, again, we start with the statistics and the problems. So I briefly mentioned there are, depending upon which study you believe, 100,000 to 400,000 medically induced deaths every year in hospitals alone. Now, yes, most of those are to older people, so it's not like they come in, you know, healthy like you or me, but still they were medically caused. They accelerated the death. And as I said, I won't go into detail again, when we do have single payer or we do have comprehensive immigration reform, we will have 11 million or more people who have high healthcare needs, limited ability to pay, are going to be covered under the system. The system is broken. We are at risk tremendously as individuals. When we go, our access is going to be less. Our wait times are going to be longer. The pressures are going to be greater. The errors are going to be greater. What can we do as individuals? Part of what I do is teach at UCSF Medical School. I am not an MD, I'm a PhD. But I do co-teach with MDs. And by being an insider there, I also get to hear a lot about what it's really like from a doctor's perspective. And I read a lot because I care a lot about medical education and all that. First of all, it's a little surprising statistic. You know that it's about 69%, I think it's about right, of oncologists would not take chemotherapy themselves. 69%. It's poisoning people, and sometimes it works, but we all know stories of people who go through this horrible chemotherapy, and then the recurrence happens pretty damn quick. Herceptin, which was the poster child drug for Genentech, which was the most prestigious biotech company in America, their poster child drug was Herceptin. And when I looked into Herceptin and I found out what really is the story of Herceptin, it increased lifespan 5 months, and a 5 months full of torture. And it cost $20,000 a dose. My point is, medical, like education, medicine is still in its adolescence. And we are still at the place, and you talk to only doctors privately, in the end, it really is still true that an ounce of prevention is worth a ton of cure. So I'm merely going to invite you to do what I'm not doing so well myself, is take care of the basics, because the system is not going to take care of you very well, I don't think. Please watch your weight, watch your stress. Please don't smoke, including pot. Again, we're hurtling headlong to legalizing pot. I wrote an article for Time Magazine, a complete review of the literature. And the activists do a great job in talking to the media and perpetrating how safe and benign it is, and that anybody who's against it is a reefer madness, right-wing GOP Republican Nazi. But to the extent to which medical marijuana is useful, it could be go through standard FDA testing and available at a CVS. That's not what medical marijuana is about. And the benignity, which is a word, is simply not true. I had, in addition to the interview, the review of literature at Time, I had a long 2-hour interview with the Obama administration. Again, no GOP. The Obama administration's head of the National Institutes for Drug Abuse. And she says the data on marijuana is terrible in terms of reducing memory, cognitive functioning, emotional stability, and increasing cancer and heart attack risk. And this does not get perpetrated, but these are not the studies by the activists or nonprofits. It's Harvard and Northwestern. And in the states where marijuana was legalized recently, in Colorado and Washington, the amount of emergency room visits has skyrocketed. The amount of children use has skyrocketed because it's available to adults, and of course, like alcohol, filters down to kids. So part of your prevention, I encourage you to not smoke or smoke a little, whether it's certainly not cigarettes and pot as well. If you've got high blood pressure, take your medication. If you've got, you know, diabetes, control it the way you, the best you can, and keep your stress down. As corny as that sounds, I know it's redundant, but in the end, that's still, and don't eat a lot of meat. Eat a largely plant-based diet. All of those things really are the most generous gift I can give to you. Don't run to doctors so fast. Okay. And societally, I'm going to just wonder, because I always promise. So that's the individual. One thing about society. Because I do teach at UCSF, and I know the curriculum damn well, and I've actually reviewed the literature on medical school training. So much, and paradoxically, ironically, ever more of medical school training is being done by academicians, narrow specialists in an arcane research area with limited experience. And the average student loan the total cost of medical school is $300,000. Even at UCSF, a public institution. We need to shorten medical school training. We need to shorten training and make more the training for all health practitioners. They don't need anymore to memorize all the nerves. They don't need to memorize all the hormones. The information, there is the internet. We need to teach people to learn how to learn, not how to memorize crap, which is dispiriting and also gives them a sense of arrogance that makes them feel like they know everything. And believe me, they don't. Right? And we're not using enough computer stimulation. There's still this old stupid phrase in medical education that says, see one, do one, teach one. You know what that means? See one lumbar puncture, do a lumbar puncture, and then teach somebody else. It takes 100 lumbar punctures to know how to do it well. That's not medical education. If we had instead of computer simulations where the computer, they can now create the feel for a needle going into skin, but virtually, they can practice virtually without hurting patients and get much more practice. That's medical education needs to be reformed. I have much more to say about medical education, about healthcare, including a two-tiered, I have to say this. I am in favor of single payer. We've got to get rid of all the middlemen. Not that government does anything efficiently. They're horribly inefficient. But I think the insurance companies are worse. I'm hearing too many reports of continuing to deny claims until the patient dies and setting up as many roadblocks as possible. They're horrible. I can't stand them. So I am in favor of single payer. But I also, from a cosmic ethical perspective, I really believe that people who have paid into the system their whole life. No, I'll say it this way. Every human being, by virtue of simply being on the planet, has a right to basic health care. They have a right for preventive care, basic treatments. But people who pay into the system should have the rights to a higher level of care, the choice of doctor, treatments that aren't slam dunk cost effective but still have efficacy. So I'm in favor of a two-tiered single, and this is the opposite of what is being called for in current plans for single payer. They want everybody, it's all in, everybody treated the same. From my sense of ethics, everybody has a right to basic health care. But that if you are paid into the system, you have a right to that higher level of care. And don't say, oh, you can buy your own privately. They do that in England. There's almost no doctors left because the system is so rigged to focus on those who are in the system that very few doctors, let alone hospitals or MRI machines or advanced technologies, available for purchase outside the system. So I believe the system, the single payer, needs to have two tiers. One for the basic rights of humanity, to get basic health care, and then a higher level. And one more, I can't help it. You've given me a little permission to go a little over, so I'm going to do it. Let me assess the group here on this. How many wish I would come to a conclusion, or how many want to hear what I have to say about Israel?
Israel.
Anybody wants me to come to a conclusion? Two. So I'm going to do Israel briefly, very briefly. Yeah, I'm not going to do I'm going to leave out the Middle East and terrorism just because I just in respect for your time. But Israel, I have a really very unusual, innovative idea that most people hate. Okay? But I believe it's the answer. I believe the United Nations was absolutely stupid or their motives were ill in putting Israel, in capitulating to the extreme religious right, the Jewish religious right, and probably Christian religious right, that wanted Israel back in its biblical homeland. That's our homeland! This is where we're going to be! Right? So that is ultimately, in my judgment, maybe it's just 20/20 hindsight, very foolish. Because Israel is surrounded by 3,000-year-long enemies. Not just Palestinians. The Palestinians were a group of Bedouins in the 1920s and 30s. They were a political creation that has been organized into a power group that the media loves. Right now, Hamas, by its own charter, calls for the destruction of Israel. Iran, the most powerful country in the Middle East, had its leaders overtly say, deny the Holocaust happens, and they also call for a nuclear Holocaust of the Jews and Israel. If you look at the map, you have this tiny sliver, and you've got these massive amount of countries with massively more population, and the birth rate in Israel of the Arabs and other Palestinians is 5 times or 3 times that of the Jews. The Jews are being buried demographically. We spend billions and billions of dollars here in the United States of America to lend to them, to fund them, to provide technical support to them, because we believe they're the only place that has women's rights in the Middle East. Although Israel has only 1.7% of the population, they have 22% of the Nobel Prize winners in the world. They're the only democracy. Many of the drugs we take, many of our smartphones are powered by Israeli technology. The leading companies, Intel and Microsoft, have branches in Israel. They improve our health care, our quality of life enormously, so we spend billions. But just like our spending in the Middle East, I feel like it's wasted. It's not going to solve the problem. So I propose that it is hubristic of us to think that we in the next 10 or 20 years are going to solve with more billions and millions of dollars, more spending more money on military aid or whatever it is to Israel. We'd be far wiser to spend a tiny fraction of that money by creating what I call New Israel. One thing the United States has is a lot of land. Israel is tiny. I come from New York. I know the state of New York. Most people don't realize that most of New York is forest land. Empty, unused forest land. And as it happens, the highest concentration of Jews in the world outside of Israel is New York City. So there is less likelihood of rampant anti-Semitism when there is such a high concentration of Jews in New York City. It also is a liberal state and a liberal city, and the United States is tolerant of radical Muslims. They're going to be tolerant of Israelis. I argue that we should create a new Israel as follows. We should take a small sliver, an Israel-sized sliver, of forest land in upstate New York, somewhere in New York. So instead of 200 Israel's worth of land in New York, they'd have 199, which would cost essentially nothing. It's already owned by the federal government. And voluntary, no forcing, of course. We make the following offer to all Israelis who want it. We will pay your resettlement cost to come to live in New Israel. It's a tiny fraction, a one-time tiny fraction of the cost. And you will have your own country. Israel, you will sign a non-aggression pact with the United States. You're never going to invade us. We're never going to invade you. You're going to be your own, but you're going to have your own country. We're not subsidizing you after you're here. We're just giving you the land that's yours. And I think that is a much more realistic chance of ending that 3,000-year-old war and death. Every family, Palestinian, Arab, or Jew, who suffers a bomb attack, even if it doesn't hit, is devastated. I believe when we think of every human life that has been affected by the Palestinian war and our billions of dollars that could be used here for education, for healthcare, for so many better purposes, I believe that while it's not a perfect solution, and certainly the radical right Jews and Christians will be very angry that we've moved Israel from the biblical homeland, net-net, I believe that's the wisest choice if we really want peace. Okay. And now, it probably won't happen because that's the real world. That's what the big ideas are about. That's what the Commonwealth Club is about, big ideas. So now, questions. And then I'll tell a story and then we say goodbye. Sorry, I didn't get to national debt, by the way, and all that some other time.
For our listening audience, we're listening to Marty Nemko talk about what's the big idea. We have one question and a couple of comments. Question is, have you done a TED Talk on any of your teaching or mentoring ideas?
I have been nominated a number of times for TED and have not been selected, to be fully honest. I don't know whether it'll happen or it doesn't, but that's one of my few things on my bucket list. I am actually quite a sad person by nature. I'm not depressed because they call dysthymic. I'm a sad person. I'm a different person in front of an audience. It's not an act. It's just this brings out everything good in me, and I'm privileged. And if TED were to allow me to speak, it would be the greatest. It's top of my bucket list.
Thanks. Another question. In reading your handout list, the many shortcomings at hand in America, we need change. Which of our presidential candidates offers the most promise to change the chaos? And if I can add on to that, how would you change the political system?
I love that question and happy to answer it. Neither candidate is good. I could not vote for Donald Trump. He is utterly unqualified to be president. Apart from politics, he is dangerous. He doesn't know anything, and he's pre-senile. I see pre-Alzheimer's signs. His discursiveness, his inability to hold a thought, he is frightening to me, apart from his policies. Let's put the policies aside. I'm very concerned about Hillary. She is the system. And she's also, she is, in my judgment, probably interminably dishonest and money grubbing. So the problem, so if I had to vote for one, put a gun, if I wanted to, I would vote for Hillary. I can't vote for Donald Trump under any circumstances. But the problem is, this, just as the caller, questioner asked, is the system. I am an advocate of a 3-week publicly funded campaign where no public, because no good candidate is going to press the flesh for 4 years making promises to fat cats and whatever. Good person won't even want to touch that smell. But if it's 3 weeks and publicly funded, and they're really their record, the League of Women Voters or other Consumer Reports or other neutral body really listed their voting record and their positions clearly and succinctly on the internet, available in libraries, 3 weeks only campaign, one or two publicly, of course, televised debates, I think that would have much better candidates running for office and lead to the change that the caller and I think is necessary in this country.
Thank you. We have some comments about the school system that is just not working, that is part of because of the government control, that people are just promoted because of age, not because of what they learn. Is there really any way to change it?
Yes, I think we need because we live in a government-controlled system. This is not a private. I'm not going to go do some libertarian argument here. The reality is the public schools dominate and are going to continue to dominate. But we need to vote for candidates who are willing to take on the unions. Because the unions want, that's their job. It's to protect jobs. Just like the pot advocate's job is not to fairly present the data. They want to advocate for pot. So as long as the unions are in the hip pocket of government, nothing will change. So at town hall meetings and in letters to the editor, asking the candidates hard questions, including school board members. This is not just nationally. We live in a local control world. Your local school board, you go to a school board meeting, you say, how come you allow the teachers' unions to allow bad teachers to keep hurting, or even mediocre teachers, to keep hurting kids 30 at a time for 30 years rather than standing up for children? If that question gets asked often enough at school board meetings, when the state superintendent of schools runs for office, right, Gavin Newsom is going to be running. I know somebody else is going to be running. If we don't ask that hard question, what are you going to say to the unions when you see incompetent teachers or marginal, when there are great people unemployed who would kill for a job where you get, after 2 years, you get tenure, you get lots of days off, vacations, pleasant environment, you're not working in a clanging carcinogenic factory. Plenty of people are unemployed who would do a better job, and yet you, the unions, are protecting them. You, Mr. Gavin Newsom, you, Ms. whoever else is running against them, what would you say to the unions? we ask those questions enough, maybe the unions will lose some power because they have an enormous lobby. I get probably 10 emails a week from the CTA, from the California Teachers Association, the union, and the, or the AFT. They're so powerful. They have the media. Society's mind control vehicles are the schools and the colleges and the government. And the unions have all three in their hip pocket. It may not work. To be honest, I think it's hopeless. I think the unions have to. We are moving leftward, and the more leftward we move, the more the union movement will be more powerful. I don't think this is going to change. But my best shot is raise the question at a meeting.
Okay. I'd like to thank Marty Nemeco for this outstanding presentation on What's the Big Idea?
Thank you very much.
And now this program.
As I said, I always end with a story. As I said, everything that I have done here is customized to you. I really believe in never doing the same presentation twice because I grow from creating a customized presentation, and that way I'm not stale. But what I'm going to do now, what I'm going to end, I end every one of my talks, and I've probably given over 1,000 at this point. I have ended every one of my talks for the last, I don't know, last 500 of them with the same story. And it's not because I promised my father I would. It's because I believe its lesson may be more important than anything I've said so far. The year was 1939. The town was Sierpce, Poland. My father was living with his parents in a very halcyon, bucolic, small town. They never locked their doors. And one day there was a knock on the door, and it was two Nazis in black boots. But unlike in the Hollywood movies, they didn't yell. One was silent. The other whispered, "You will be out of your house with only what you can carry on your back by noon tomorrow, or else." And by noon the next day, there weren't two Nazis. There were 12. But there were two trucks. And my father's parents were put in one truck, and my father was put in another, and my father never saw his parents again. He and 11 men escaped from a concentration camp by digging a tunnel under the barrack, sandy soil. He had the luck of having a barrack that was right next to the barbed wire fence, and they escaped, using the slats of their bed to hold it up. And he lived for a year in the Black Forest, thanks to the good Christians who took care of him. At the end of the war, he was dropped on a cargo boat in the Bronx without a penny to his name, no money, no English, no education, only the scars of the Holocaust tortures. What did he do? No job was beneath him. He took a job sewing shirts in a factory in Harlem. And what did he do at night when he was exhausted after the 10-hour day? Did he say, "I'm going to go get shit-faced"? No. He went to Roosevelt High School night school in the Bronx to learn English. Because he knew unless he learned good English, he would always be making minimum wage. And what did he do on Saturdays? Did he say, "I worked so hard during the week, I'm going to watch Saturday morning football"? No. He went to the owner of the factory and said, "Can I sell the shirts that I sewed for you during the week out of a cardboard box on the streets?" And he bought them for $1 a piece and sold them for $1.50. And at the end of Saturday, what did he do? He said, "I'm tired, I'm exhausted, I want to watch TV. Am I going to spend the money? No. He started to save the money until he could afford the first and last month's rent on the only store he could afford, 105 Moore Street in Brooklyn. And you can Google Maps it now. It is still one of the worst neighborhoods in New York. Because my dad met my mom. She's also a Holocaust survivor, Auschwitz, at that night school learning English. And my dad didn't want my mom or me or my sister we lived under the elevated train that roared 24/7 in a terrible tenement in the Bronx. He wanted to get us out of there. So he saved up until he could afford that first and last month's rent on 105 Moore Street. And on one side, there was a Puerto Rican deli that specialized in chicharrones, which is deep fried pork intestines. On the other side, there was a live chicken market. And the smell of the stale blood merged with the chicharrones, right at my father's little clothing store. Perfect location. And the store was so small, it was really about 200 square feet, that he could store very little merchandise inside. Most of it had to be on folding tables outside. But as I said, this is a very bad neighborhood. So on Saturdays, the kids would come by and they would steal. They would just grab full boxes of shirts, sunglasses, whatever. So as soon as he couldn't afford a security guard. So as soon as I got old enough, I was 13, he had me be the security guard. And if you think I look nerdy now, you should have seen me then. Anyway, the most memorable moment of my childhood was one Saturday when business was slow, and there's a parking meter in front of the store. And I remember having my elbow on one side of the parking meter, and my dad having his elbow on the other. And suddenly it strikes me, I say, Daddy, how come you so rarely talk about the Holocaust? And he stiffened, something he rarely did. And he said, Martin, the Nazis took 5 years from my life. I won't give them 1 minute more. He said, Martin, never look back. Always take the next step forward. And each and every one of us has had shit happen to us. But I have had the privilege of having been career and personal coach to 5,000 people now. And one of the key differentiating factors is that the successful ones, yeah, they had all kinds of shit happen to them, but it's how they responded. The successful ones responded much more often with following my father's advice. Never look back. Always take the next step forward. And I can leave you with no better advice. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And so this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating 114 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.